Terribly, and you're listening to the Divided Kingdom radio show. Well, did any of you listen to the Oscars a few nights back? I didn't, mainly because I don't have a TV set, although I think I probably wouldn't have listened anyway, because to me it's pretty boring with all the long speeches and all the political commenting, I guess is the right word. But here's a couple of things that appeared in newspapers a day or two later. First one's from the New York Post. I'll just give you a few highlights. It says, "Face it, Hollywood, you're boring viewers with your self-righteous, out-of-touch, navel-gazing Oscars." This was by Kristen Fleming, as I said, the New York Post, March 16th, 2026, which would have been Monday. In his Oscars tribute to slain director Rob Reiner on Sunday, Billy Crystal referenced some of his old friend's most iconic movies, from a Spinal Tap to The Princess Bride to A Few Good Men, invoking the star and most famous line from that 1992 classic. "And Jack Nicholson, who warned us, you can't handle the truth," which is simply what we all want today. The line was meant, I presume, as a jab at the Trump administration. For a group of people both devoted to make-believe, yet supposedly hungry for truth, is one that Hollywood stubbornly refuses to admit to itself. That is, outside of Los Angeles Dolby Theater, no one gives a rat's behind about 75% of what goes on at the Oscars. The normie, I think that means a normal audience at home, wants to see glamorous A-listers in their red carpet splendor. They want to laugh at dazzling monologues. They want showbiz, baby. Instead, the Oscars increasingly delivers navel-gazing slop, thanks to a glut of behind-the-scenes awards. Do we really want to know who is tops at sound editing, of visual effects, or the newest category watering down the show's entertainment value? Best achievement in casting? It took five actors, including Gwyneth Paltrow, who lost me when she used the empty words "lived experience," to introduce the nominees. Also slowing things down, cinematographer Autumn Durald Acapar celebrated her win as the first female recipient by urging every woman in the room to stand up, because she wouldn't be there without them. Yeah. Leonardo DiCaprio's 27-year-old model girlfriend was totally integral. Unlike the Grammys, which is a concert with skimpy outfits and only a few awards, the Oscars feels like a slog, like much of it should take place on a Tuesday afternoon in a hotel ballroom. It's why the Emmys have a separate Creative Arts Award ceremony, so as not to bore their viewers to death. That's what host Conan O'Brien was for. After lending a few good lines about Timothée Chalamet and the Fiat AI takeover of Hollywood, his shtick went south. Noting that no Brits were nominated in the Best Actor category, he quipped, "A British spokesperson said, yeah, but at least we arrest our pedophiles." That might come as news to all the young girls who were victimized by grooming gangs there. And somewhere from hell, late BBC pedo Jimmy Savile, never arrested, was laughing maniacally. During his monologue, it felt like O'Brien was on an Oscars justification tour for the show even being aired, noting that there were 31 countries across six continents represented among the nominees. Quote, "With people speaking different languages, working hard to make something of beauty, we pay tribute tonight not just to film, but to the ideals of global artistry, collaboration, patience, resilience, and that rarest of qualities today, optimism," unquote. Another pat on the back. Despite the public's very small appetite for Hollywood lectures, actors' enthusiasm for delivering them has never been greater. It must have been tough for Javier Bardem, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, because I never heard of him. But it must have been tough for Javier Bardem to choose between two virtual signaling accessories. On Sunday, he wore an old anti-war button and beamed like a child to get a sticker from the dentist for having no cavities. Presenting the award for Best International Feature Film, Bardem smugly barked his favorite, utterly meaningless phrase, Free Palestine. He forgot to add, from Hamas. But seriously, for all of the ice-out accessories, not one word was spared for the brave Iranian women's soccer team who, sadly, face a life-or-death decision of whether to return home to a brutal regime. For me, the highlight of the night was Hamnet star Jessie Buckley accepting her Best Actress award. The new mom delivered a speech that was, as a friend rightfully said to me, beautifully transgressive. She praised motherhood as something that has not impeded her dreams, but fulfilled them and made her professional success richer. She wanted to make 20,000 more babies with her husband. And she said, this is Jessie Buckley saying, I would like to dedicate this to the beautiful chaos of a mother's heart. It was a stark contrast to Michelle Williams, who, at the 2020 Golden Globes, drew a direct line from her resume in film to abortion, saying she couldn't have achieved what she did, quote, without employing a woman's right to choose, unquote. But the Oscars is not long for broadcast television. In 2029, it will be 100 years old and at home on YouTube, where we will no doubt all tune in to see who wins Best Craft Services. Well, as I say, I didn't watch it, didn't have a TV. Oh, I got a TV, but I don't have the hookup for cable or satellite. And I, frankly, haven't gotten around to hooking up an antenna to bring in the local stations, because I don't miss it much. Certainly don't miss the Oscars. That's one of the last things I would watch. But some people like that. So if you like it, more power to you. Here's something else having to do with the Oscars. This was from the Western Journal. The previous one, by the way, was the New York Post on March 16th. This one was also March 16th from the Western Journal. And it says, watch. Jimmy Kimmel takes a cheap shot at Melania from the Oscar stage. That's the movie Melania, not the person, although it might well be the person too. And the title continues, the backlash is brutal. This is by Joe Saunders, March 16th, 2026. For a fading host of a fading Hollywood awards ceremony, First Lady Melania Trump was too easy a target to ignore. Late night comedian Jimmy Kimmel used the Oscars stage Sunday at the Los Angeles Dolby Theater to take a cheap shot at President Donald Trump's wife while demonstrating how little truth actually matters to the modern left. And while he got a forced laugh from his audience, the social media blowback was far louder. Kimmel said, quote, there are some countries whose leaders don't support free speech. I'm not at liberty to say which. And Kimmel said that on the nationally televised program while introducing the award for documentary short film, according to The Hill. He went on to say, just leave it at North Korea and CBS, unquote. That was an apparent reference to the coming cancellation of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, a nightly festival of Trump hatred that's due to leave the air in May. And this, I believe, is also a quote from Kimmel. Fortunately for all of us, there is an international community of filmmakers dedicated to telling the truth. Oftentimes a great risk to make films that teach us, that call out injustice, that inspire us to take action. And there are also documentaries where you walk around the White House trying on shoes, unquote. The reference, of course, was to the documentary Melania, which Hollywood hated and millions of Americans loved. Kimmel then made the point again while introducing the documentary feature film category, according to The Hill. Kimmel said, quote, oh, man, is he going to be mad his wife wasn't nominated for this, unquote. The problem with Kimmel's jokes, aside from being predictable and not even close to funny, is that they're based on lies. CBS didn't cancel Colbert for political reasons. It canceled the show because it's a money loser. And Trump being upset that Melania wasn't nominated for an Oscar? The documentary came out in January. It wasn't even eligible for an award ceremony that honored work released last year. And it says the libs at Newsweek spent basically a whole article explaining why Melania, I believe this is the title, why Melania, Trump's documentary, wasn't nominated for an Oscar, when it all could have been boiled down to one paragraph. And this is also a quote from Newsweek. In Melania's case, while the film did receive a theatrical release in late January 2026, that timing placed it outside the eligibility window for the 98th Oscars, which honors films released during the 2025 calendar year. So it's possible that Melania's film could be eligible for an Oscar in 2026, unquote. Kimmel and his writers both had to know these things. An audience full of show business professionals had to know it too, however shallow and stupid they might be. But they all joined in the cheap shots at a president the beautiful people love to hate. And many, many social media users called them out. Here's a sampling. I guess that was perhaps in the original article. I don't see it here. But as conservative commentator Jeffrey Blahard noted at National Review, the once-must-watch awards ceremony is going to be shown only on the web starting in 2029, an indication of how few Americans actually care what Hollywood is celebrating about itself. As Sunday night's Kimmel jokes showed, it's clearly not about celebrating the truth. So that was from the Western Journal by Joe Saunders, dated March 16th, 2026. All right, so you're listening to The Divided Kingdom. This is a show begun mainly by my wife, Elizabeth, who sadly passed away just over a year ago, about 13 months ago. And I've tried to continue it. I hope I'm doing a good job. And if you'd like to contribute to keep this show in the air, I certainly welcome that very much. And if you'd just like to write, if you can't contribute, but you'd like to write your opinions, good or bad, I'll accept either one. Just write to me, Lou, L-O-U, Caverly, C-A-V-E-R-L-Y. And the address is Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. That's Lou Caverly, P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And if you didn't get that, didn't have a pencil handy, I'll repeat that later in the program. And you can go to our website. And now I guess I have to say it's my website, now that I don't have Elizabeth with me. My website is DividedKingdomRadio.com. DividedKingdomRadio.com. You can listen to our old shows on there, going back several years, in fact. And they're all grouped by date. Just go to the show archives on that website, DividedKingdomRadio.com. There are essays. I better put some new ones in. Haven't put any in for a while, but I intend to do just that. It's a nice tribute, too, to Elizabeth. Many of you remember her, I'm sure. Well, now let's move on to a whole different kind of article, one from the Gateway Pundit. Report: New York City spent approximately $81,000 per person on services for the homeless last year. This is by Mike LaChance, March 16th. And this data is according to the New York State Comptroller. I think it's the state, or it could be the city controller. April, I'm not sure. According to that person, New York City spent an eye-popping $81,000 per person on services for the homeless last year. This leads to some obvious questions. Why are there still homeless people in New York City? How does the city spend this kind of money and still have a homeless problem? Also, would it not have been better to just give $81,000 to each homeless person on the condition that they get off the street? Couldn't that have worked better in the end? And some of this is coming by way of the New York Post, by the way. New York City spent roughly $81,000 per person on the homeless services last year, amounting to a whopping $368 million in total bills, a shocking new state report found. And let's see what else we have here. I'm going to skip down just a little. According to the city's Department of Homeless Services, Street Homeless Solutions Division, the spending more than tripled over the last 6 years, from $102 million in 2019, or about $28,000 per, quote, unsheltered homeless person, unquote, according to a report from the state controller's office. So it is the state controller. The cost per person was roughly equivalent to the city's median household income as of the 2024 U.S. Census, $81,226 annually. So, that brings up an interesting question. This is Lou speaking now. Why work when they'll spend as much on you as the median household income? That means if you line them all up in a row, in order of size, the household incomes, and pick the middle one, that's the median. Where's all that money going? Well, let's see what the article continues saying. Now, unsheltered homeless people constitute those living regularly on the streets compared to those who are in some sort of affordable housing or long-term shelter system. The Big Apple's unsheltered homeless population increased by 26% over the same time frame, the report released by Controller Thomas P. DiNapoli found. About 3,588 unsheltered homeless people were reported in the 2019 fiscal year, while 4,505 were reported in fiscal year 2025. One of the many problems with homelessness in American cities is that there are too many people making a lot of money solving, and that's in quotes, solving the problem, which never gets solved and only seems to grow. Comedian and podcaster Adam Carolla recently talked about this problem, and although he was referring to Los Angeles, it's the same in New York City. He notes that when his friend, Dr. Drew Pinsky, offered his services as an addiction specialist for free to the city of Los Angeles, the woke members of the city council turned him down. The problem will never be solved with the leftists in charge of cities. They do not want it solved. Too many people are making a living from it because it has been turned into an industry. There is no incentive to fix the problem. That from the Gateway Pundit, March 16th, 2026. As I mentioned, and most of you already know, my wife Elizabeth sadly passed away about 13 months ago. It was 13 months ago yesterday. And, of course, Elizabeth really got the problem, the program rolling, the Divided Kingdom, at a time when I was so tied up with full-time work that I really didn't have much time to devote to it. And this article really hit home. If someone who lost a loved one not too many months ago, get this. This is from the New York Post, March 16th, by Zoe Hussein. And the title reads, Grief author Corey Richens found guilty of fatally poisoning her husband, for his $4 million estate after 3 hours of jury deliberation. Utah Children's Grief author Corey, that's K-O-U-R-I, Richens, R-I-C-H-I-N-S, was found guilty on Monday of fatally poisoning her husband in a twisted plot to bail herself out of debt with his $4 million estate and run away with her handyman lover. The jury in Park City hands down the guilty verdict after roughly 3 hours of deliberations, following a three-week trial where prosecutors painted Richens as an egotistical social climber who slipped a fatal dose of fentanyl into her husband Eric's Moscow Mule cocktail on March 4, 2022. The 35-year-old mom of three, who penned a children's book about her kid's grief after the murder, appeared defeated and hung her head low as the guilty verdicts were read on aggravated murder, attempted aggravated murder, insurance fraud, and forgery. She was also found guilty of trying to poison him a month earlier, on Valentine's Day, with a fentanyl-laced sandwich that made him break out in hives and black out. Richens, this is, again, Corey Richens is the guilty person. Her home flipping business was $4.5 million in debt when she hatched the sinister scheme to try to cash in Eric's estate and start a new life with her lover, Robert Josh Grossman. Prosecutor Brad Bloodworth told jurors during blistering closing arguments earlier Monday. I presume that would have been Monday the 9th of 2026. Corey, who lives with her husband and kids in Camas, a suburb of the wealthy ski town Park City, was an, quote, incompetent, unquote, businesswoman who, quote, carefully curated the facade of a privileged, affluent, successful business owner, Prosecutor Bloodworth argued. The way forward for the conniving wannabe socialite was that, quote, Eric had to die, unquote, the prosecutor continued. Richens asked Grossman, Grossman was again the boyfriend, the lover. Richens asked Grossman, the married mom's secret lover and a 43-year-old Iraq war veteran, if he'd ever killed anyone, just days after she fatally slipped fentanyl into her hubby's cocktail. Richens posed the question in March 2022 as the pair discussed 39-year-old Eric's sudden death for the first time. The handyman testified earlier in the trial. Richens wrote and promoted a kid's book named Are You With Me? A year after the poisoning plot to help their sons process their loss. Bloodsworth, that's the prosecutor, told jurors, quote, she wanted to leave Eric Richens, but did not want to leave his money. That prenup meant if she left him, she would also leave most of his money, unquote. Throughout the prosecution's arguments, Richens derisively smirked and made faces, including furrowing her eyebrows, grinning, and occasionally hurriedly leaning over and speaking with the defense team. The failed house flipper's defense lawyer, Kathy Nestor, made a bid for a mistrial, claiming Bloodworth had made missteps during his closing. That would be closing arguments. But the motion was shot down by Judge Richard Mrazek. Richens, who pleaded not guilty to the crimes, faces up to 25 years behind bars. She is slated to be sentenced on May 13th. And this is Liz speaking. I think if she got 25 years, that would not be too much. This is cold-blooded murder. Plotted, planned, and carried out. So 25 years seems pretty lenient to me. Maybe I'm just a hanging judge, a wannabe hanging judge. But that's my honest opinion. Anyway, that was from the New York Post, and it was published on March 16th. The shortwave version of the title is Grief Author Found Guilty of Fatally Poisoning Her Husband. All right. Now, on a happier note, and I mean happier because that's part of the title. This was from Zero Hedge, also on March 16th. Nordic nations rank among happiest and wealthiest in the world. Does money buy happiness? The world's richest countries generate staggering income per person. But when it comes to life satisfaction, some of the wealthiest nations fall surprisingly short. This graphic, and you'll have to go to the website to see it, via visual capitalist Bruno Venditti, compares GDP per capita based on IMF data with happiness scores from the World Happiness Report, which asks people to rate their lives on a scale of 0 to 10. Now, if you go to this website at Zero Hedge and look for this article, it has a little table here, and I'll just summarize it briefly. There's two columns. The left column shows the wealthiest countries, and this is GDP per capita, per person. And in a matching column, it shows the happiest countries, according to a rating score. Now, the U.S. is in the middle of the top 20. It's number 11 in the wealthiest. And keep in mind, some of these countries are very small countries by comparison. I think if you were to take what usually would be considered a sizable country, the U.S. is the only one I see that's really a pretty big country in terms of wealth. The top five are Liechtenstein, which I think is in Europe. I better get out my world atlas and check it out. Singapore, which is really not much more than a big city. Luxembourg, which is a tiny little country in Europe. Ireland, which is somewhat bigger. And Macau. And I should know where that is, but I don't honestly know. And 6 through 10 are Qatar, Guyana in South America, Norway, Switzerland, and Brunei. Now, the happiest ones, some of those were not even on that list of the wealthiest. At the top is Finland. Second, Denmark. Third, Iceland. Fourth, Sweden. Fifth, Netherlands. Sixth, Costa Rica. Seventh, Norway. Eighth, Israel. Ninth, Luxembourg. And 10th, Mexico. So that's interesting. And once again, there really isn't a large country in those top 10. The United States didn't make the list. And looking down there, I don't see any country that's pretty good size, except for Canada. Canada was number 18 on the list. The list are comparatively small countries. Now, let's see. I'm going to skip down because it's just, without seeing all the facts in front of you, it wouldn't be too much value to read most of this. But there's Nordic countries, that would be Northern Europe, like Finland, Sweden, and so forth, Denmark, Iceland. It says they consistently perform well on the rating of the happiest countries. And it reflects strong social safety nets, high trust in institutions, and broad access to public services. Only a handful of countries rank near the top on both wealth and happiness, making them rare global outliers. Denmark, Iceland, Norway, Luxembourg, Sweden, I should say Switzerland, Ireland, and the Netherlands stand out as rare examples where high incomes coincide with high life satisfaction. This overlap is especially strong in Northern Europe. These countries tend to pair high productivity with robust welfare systems, universal health care, and relatively low income inequality. The data shows that while wealth matters, it isn't the whole story. Trust, Social support and access to public services appear to play a major role in how satisfied people feel with their lives. All right, interesting. Again, that was from Zero Hedge by Tyler Durden, who is one of their chief authors, Monday, March 16th. And the title was Nordic Nations Rank Among Happiest and Wealthiest in the World. Now, from there, we'll go to something that also was by Tyler Durden, also at Zero Hedge. And this has to do with something that's close to my heart, not that I want it. Its title says, Alaskans carry the most lifetime credit card debt of all Americans. Iowans, the lowest. This appeared on Sunday, March 15th, again from ZeroHedge.com. The average American accumulates nearly $400,000 in credit card debt over their lifetime. But the total varies significantly depending on where people live. Some states, the typical lifetime total exceeds $450,000. While in others, it sits closer to $320,000. Now, again, without the website in front of you, I'm going to have to jump down a little bit. They have a nice map that's color-coded and ranks the 50 states in terms of credit card debt. And it says average credit card debt accumulated over the average American lifespan, age 18 to 78. Now, again, I'll just name the ones with some of the highest debt. Alaska tops the list. Second is New Jersey, then Connecticut, Hawaii, and Maryland for the top five. That's my state of Maryland that I live in. Well, I've contributed a little bit to that statistic over my lifetime. I've chipped in with my credit cards to get into debt. Hopefully I'll be able to crawl out one day before I die. And Texas is the next in line. Then Florida, Nevada, Colorado, Georgia, and Virginia. Now, where is my original home state of Massachusetts? It's at number 15. But the difference is not huge. The top of the list, the indebtedness is $484,000. Massachusetts is $411,000. Well, $70,000 difference is not to be sneezed at, but it's still a lot of money. If you go way down the list, all the way down to number 50, what do we find at the bottom? Well, the very bottom, as they said before, is Iowa. The bottom five, the least in debt, are Mississippi, West Virginia, Kentucky, Wisconsin, and Iowa. And let me just back up a little bit. It says New Jerseyans and Connecticut citizens racked up $456,300 and $454,080 of credit card debt in their lifetimes, respectively, reflecting higher costs of rent, food, and utilities. Interestingly, those two states have good salaries compared to other states, suggesting higher income enables greater access to credit. So this is Liz speaking now. So I guess what that means is if you are making more, you're going to borrow more. Your standard of living is higher, and you kind of, in spite of good jobs, you're not living within your means, which was the problem for myself and Elizabeth for many years. And an interesting point here, Kentucky, where public school students must complete a financial literacy course before graduating, trails at only $323,940. So it sounds like that state is doing something right. All right. They mentioned that consumer debt has risen in recent years. Consumer spending plays a crucial role in the U.S. economy. It accounted for nearly 70% of gross domestic product in the third quarter of 2025. Meanwhile, over half, 56% of all credit card users have some kind of revolving credit card debt, which is where payments are deferred for periodic installments, highlighting debt's parallel role. In other words, to put it simply, they're not paying off the full amount they owe each month. They're carrying some debt. And I was wondering how they're arriving at this total debt figure. I presume they are adding up all the debt at any one time. I don't think very many people have $400,000 all at once in credit card debt. I don't know how many credit cards that will let you do that. But if you add it up month by month over the course of a lifetime, I can see where they get these statistics from. Well, that's an interesting article. And if you want to see those graphics, tables, and also a map, very good map that shows a lifetime credit card debt, you can see that by going to Zero Hedge on the internet. An article by Tyler Durden, March 15th, 2026. This title, Alaskans Carry the Most Lifetime Credit Card Debt of All Americans, and Iowans the Least. All right, what else do we have here? Now, here's something to get you itching. It says here, bed bug nightmare spreading across the South as cases surge in multiple states. This is Fox News by Kelly McGreal, March 15th, 2026. Well, bed bugs. I've heard of those. I fortunately never had an occasion to have them in my house that I'm aware of. But I hear that pesky little critters, I've been invaded with mice lately. I can tell you all about mice, and they have gone the way. Well, no, they haven't gone the way of the dodo quite yet. Out of my house, I think I have one or two more. I think I can hear a few little things. I've gotten in good old fashioned mouse traps, I guess about six or seven in the last 3 weeks. But that's near the end of that. Let's see what we have here for the bed bugs. Again, this is from Fox News. Travel expert Colleen Kelly offers essential tips for navigating expected travel chaos during spring break as TSA staffing shortages and the government shutdown continue. Spring break travelers heading to popular destinations in the United States may want to be extra cautious about what they bring home. Pest control reports indicate that bed bug infestations linked to travel appear to be increasing in several southern states. A recent report from Terminix, and I'll just interject there, they should know because they're in the pest control business. A recent report from Terminix in Atlanta ranked Georgia sixth nationwide for bed bug service requests among the 50 most affected U.S. cities. Other southern states, such as Florida, Texas, and Tennessee, have also reported growing concerns tied to travel-related infestations. New York-based travel expert Lee Abamonte told Fox News Digital that travelers may face a higher risk of encountering bed bugs in certain types of accommodations. Abamonte said, quote, bed bugs often arise in places frequented by younger, more budget-friendly tourists. That includes places like popular spring destinations for students or youth hostels, unquote. And, of course, it's probably just past the time now for spring break from colleges. They all seem to have pretty much the same schedule when it comes to spring break. I think we're probably a little beyond that now. I'm not positive about that. Haven't kept up with it. Well, the article goes on to say these locations often experience frequent guest turnover and crowded rooms, which can make thorough cleaning more difficult, he said. And he went on, and this, again, is authority fully abominant. He said, young people and students generally don't care about the state of the room. They just want to be in the destination as cheaply as possible, unquote. Bed bugs are small, flat insects that typically hide in dark cracks and crevices near where people sleep, according to the Terminix report. The pests are frequently found along mattress seams, behind headboards, inside furniture joints, in their baseboards in hotel rooms and short-term rentals. Fox News Digital previously reported that travel is one of the most common ways bed bugs spread from place to place. Benjamin Pottle, a Georgia-based entomologist with Orkin, that, of course, is another pest control company, Benjamin Hoddle told Fox News Digital that the pests are skilled at, quote, hitchhiking, unquote, on personal belongings. He noted that travelers can unknowingly carry bed bugs onto planes, into hotels, and eventually back home. Hotel or hotel recommends inspecting luggage and clothing after trips and placing travel clothes in a dryer on high heat for about 30 to 45 minutes if exposure is suspected. That can help eliminate the insects before they spread inside the home. And it mentions that Kelly Begriel, the author, is a production assistant for the lifestyle team at Fox News Digital. Again, that was from Fox News. Bed bug nightmare spreading across South. And that article appeared on March the 15th, 2026. Again, let me take a little break here and mention that I still have two or three copies left of the book Elizabeth and I wrote called COVID and Coming Chaos. And the COVID cases don't seem as serious as they did several years ago, thank goodness. In fact, I visited a friend in the hospital just about 3 weeks ago, and that friend, the very same evening, texted me that she had been tested and tested positive for COVID and the flu. But fortunately, I and another friend that was visiting that first friend, I didn't catch anything. But COVID is still around. I don't think it's as bad as it was, but it's not totally gone. So that little book we wrote can be very valuable. You can get a free copy of it. We would ask if you could to put maybe $5 in to cover the postage, but if you can't do that, we'll still send it out. But there aren't many left. Going to have to be first come, first serve, and you can get it just by writing to me, Blue Caverly. Give you a second to get a pen and pencil there, if you don't already have that. All you have to do is just say, please send me your book. And as long as the supply doesn't run out, I'll be happy to send them out within a day or two of receiving your request. The address to send that request to is Lou Caverly, C-A-V-E-R-L-Y, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. That's Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And as I said before, you can go to our website, DividedKingdomRadio.com. DividedKingdomRadio.com. You can see the other possible ways to hear the show. Some of you have listened to it on shortwave Thursday evenings at 8 o'clock Eastern Time. That's on a frequency of 4.840. You can also go to WWCR. If you forget what those initials are, just think of Worldwide Christian Radio. That's where the initials come from. WWCR.com, and you can look at that schedule. And Thursday evening at 8, I believe they have four transmitters, and you can just check which one we're on. I think it, I think I may have said number three, but I believe it's number two. You can hear it Saturday mornings. The show repeats the same show. Saturday morning, 8 o'clock a.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time. And the frequency there is 7490 megahertz. And there are some other ways, too. Our lady who does our website and has done it free of charge for many years now, very kind of her. She has some really good networks that have a lot of good repeats of Dr. Stan Monty's shows and other good shows, as well as some new shows of her own. And one of those websites is kstartalkradio.com. kstartalkradio.com. No punctuation there, just kstar, as if it's all one word. There's also Kingdom Star Radio that I believe is still operating. KingdomStarRadio.com. And those are two of the very good ways you can hear this. Now, we have a few more minutes left. Here's something that was appearing in the Western Journal. And, of course, I haven't been covering too much about Iran because it's changing day by day. I record this, generally speaking, on Tuesday afternoons. You won't hear it till Thursday. Most of you, if then, and some not till Saturday. So much of what I would say on Tuesday in this fast-moving story would be obsolete. But here's something that has to do with the Iran situation. Appearing in the Western Journal on March 16th, ABC News left out crucial context in story about Iran drone threat to California. This is by Jason Cohen. ABC News Wednesday report on an alleged Iranian drone threat to California did not initially include that the information was unverified. Well, this is loose speaking now. That makes a big difference. If you say it as if it's fact, you can get people very stirred up over something that may just be a rumor. Well, let's see what the article says. This is a quotation from ABC News. And ABC News, it says, reported that the late February alert stated as follows. We recently acquired information that as of early February 2026, Iran allegedly aspired to conduct a surprise attack using unmanned aerial vehicles from an unidentified vessel off the coast of the United States, specifically against unspecified targets in California, in the event that the U.S. conducted strikes against Iran. Oh, of course, that's happened. I think we're 2 weeks into that, those strikes in Iran now. However, the outlet noted in an updated version of the article on Thursday, which included an editor's note, that the full alert reportedly included the word unverified between the words acquired and information. It should have said, the FBI has posted a fuller version of its alert to California authorities, which includes that the information was unverified. And ABC News went on to say the latest version of this story has been updated, and it includes the full statement. A screenshot posted by FBI spokesperson Ben Williamson on X Thursday highlighted the discrepancy, noting that either ABC News or its source reported the FBI alert without the crucial word. And that's interesting because I don't think earlier in this article it mentioned that that was from the FBI. Well, maybe it did once. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt also urged an immediate retraction from ABC News in a Thursday X post. Ms. Leavitt said, this post and story should be immediately retracted by ABC News for providing false information to intentionally alarm the American people. They wrote this based on one email that was sent to local law enforcement in California about a single unverified tip. And Ms. Leavitt went on to say, the email even states the tip was based on unverified intelligence. Yet ABC News left out this critical factor in their story. Why? To be clear, no such threat from Iran to our homeland exists, and it never did, unquote. Those, again, were the words of Caroline Leavitt, White House press secretary. Moreover, Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom posted on X Wednesday that his administration was, quote, not aware of any imminent threats at this time, unquote. And the rest of the article just repeats what we all know, that the U.S. launched attacks in Iran on February 28th. Well, of course, this could happen. In the World War II, Japan sent a whole bunch of, I think they were balloons, weaponized balloons, across the Pacific. And I don't think any of them did any real damage, much less the loss of life. But that's the kind of thing that would shake people up, of course. That appeared in the Western Journal by Jason Cohen, March 16th. ABC News left out crucial context and story. Okay, I'm going to wind things up today with a little article from the Western Journal that says, the best quote on Islam that you've never heard. Winston Churchill predicted Europe's fall to Islam all the way back in 1899. This is by Samuel Short, who is a, let me get his credentials correct, he's an assistant professor of history with Montello State Community College in Smyrna, Tennessee. And I don't know if I said this, this appeared March 15th, 2026, Sunday, March 15th. Former Prime Minister, British Prime Minister Sir Winston Churchill recognized Islam's threat to Europe in 1899. If only he could see the continent today. That year, Churchill published The River War, an historical account of the reconquest of the Sudan, telling the account of Field Marshal Lord Horatio Kitchener's conquest of that country. Now, I'm going to break there and just give you a little background, much of which I'm getting from a book that I enjoyed a couple of times, read it a couple of times, called The White Nile. It appeared in the 1960s by Alan Moorhead. He was also the author of a book called The Blue Nile. The White Nile is the main part of the Nile that goes from its source in Lake Victoria in Central Africa all the way down to its junction with the Blue Nile that comes in from the Ethiopian highlands. The two together then merge to create the Nile proper that goes all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, up through the desert, up through Egypt, past the pyramids, to the Mediterranean. And I may give a little more of this next week. I see our time is running short. In about 1878, an Arab leader called the Mahdi, M-A-H-D-I, which I think is a title, not a personal name, arose, got a big following, and all of a sudden started winning big victories over the Egyptian garrisons in the Sudan, which is south of Egypt. And it just happened that in Khartoum, and there was a movie, by the way, that describes this, a number of years back, or actually a number of decades back, in the movie Khartoum, General Charles Gordon, a real figure, was sort of the British hero. He took over the British garrison in Khartoum, and the British did not, for the longest time, send any kind of relief expedition. This Mahdi gave several ultimatums to Gordon to surrender the city of Khartoum, and Gordon, because he was afraid the people would be massacred, hung on to the end, and he himself was killed when the Mahdi's Muslim soldiers attacked Khartoum and conquered the city. And then Britain, for several years, did nothing. And there was an outcry. Queen Victoria was crestfallen that General Gordon was killed, but they did nothing. The British Prime Minister, finally the public made such an outcry that They sent an expedition under Lord Kitchener, and in the Battle of Omdurman, he defeated the Mahdi's forces. By that time, the Mahdi had grown old and fat and died of natural causes, I believe. But his followers were defeated decisively in that battle. Winston Churchill was, as a very young man, in his, I don't think he was even 30 years old at the time, wrote a book afterward. He was one of the men in that reconquest, you might call it, of the Sudan. He spells it S-O-U-D-A-N. That's interesting. Nowadays, it's spelled S-U-D-A-N. Yeah, it says, for context, this was a young Churchill, not even 30 years old, and yet to arise to the political heights history would remember him for. And on the little bit of time remaining, I'll give you a couple of quotes from Churchill. Individual Muslims may show splendid qualities, but the influence of religion paralyzes the social development of those who follow it. No stronger retrograde force exists in the world. Apart from being a moribund, Mohammedanism is a militant and proselytizing faith. It has already spread throughout Central Africa, raising fearless warriors at every step. And were it not that Christianity is sheltered in the strong arm of science, the science against which it had vainly struggled, the civilization of modern Europe might fall, as fell the civilization of ancient Rome. So those are quotes from that very book, The River, what was its title now? The River War, The River of Crispin Ganano. And there are several other good things in here, but I hear our music coming on. So if you'd like to read a bit more of this, go to thewestonjournal.com. Look for the article of March 15th, 2026, The Best Quote on Islam That You've Never Heard. And I would recommend the book. The book called The White Nile goes from the early explorations of the Nile way back about 1850 or so, when the source of the Nile was unknown, right up to the early 20th century. Very interesting book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And even though it's old, it has a lot of good stuff in it. The White Nile by Ellen Moorhead. Well, our time is up. Thanks for listening. Write to me at Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Thanks for listening, and tune in again next week. Good night.